This week on Capitalism, Race and Democracy.
For many months, Yahya, we actually tried to conceal his identity to protect him, because you know that being a journalist, wearing the journalist vest actually makes you a target.
Israeli forces have killed over 180 journalists in Gaza and the West Bank.
The role of big tech in this latest chapter of the Palestinian dispossession and genocide will go down as a decisive factor in the story, I would say.
The assault on Gaza is not only being waged through bombs and blockades, it is also being reinforced by digital infrastructure, surveillance technology, and global media narratives.
In terms of jihadist terrorism and war crimes, Erdogan is a major accomplice. They are responsible for millions of people's bloodshed, and they are responsible for Alevite people is now massacred and executed by Golani regime in Syria.
Turkish journalist Daria Koja explains how Turkey's President Erdogan has fueled Islamic fundamentalism and helped elevate an Al-Qaeda affiliate to power in Syria. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. Ahlam Mukhtaseb is a professor of communication at California State University, San Bernardino, and producer of the film 1948, Creation and Catastrophe. She spoke at the UC People's Tribunal on Palestine and talked about the killing of Gaza journalist Yahya Sobeh. Israeli forces have killed over 180 journalists in Gaza and the West Bank, including Palestinian-American Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh.
Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Hello, everyone. Ila Yahya. To Yahya. I'm going to start first with an obituary from our team, the Phoenix of Gaza, and then I will try to actually share with you the words of Yahya before his brutal killing in Gaza 3 days ago. And lastly, we will see a video together. It is with a heavy heart and so much pain that we share the devastating news that our beloved colleague and photojournalist Yahya Sobeh was martyred in Gaza a few hours ago. This is 3 days ago. His brutal, senseless killing came just hours after he shared the news of the birth of his baby, Sana. He called her Amira, actually, in his last post on Instagram, holding his baby Sama and calling him her my princess. You brought light to my life. Surrounded by family and friends in celebration, he was killed by an Israeli airstrike on a restaurant full of civilians, as usually Israel does. His brother-in-law, celebrating with Yahya, was killed too, following his wife, Yahya's sister, who was killed last year. Yahya, like many Gazans, lost many members of his family due to the ongoing genocide. The Phoenix of Gaza XR team is beyond devastated and heartbroken. We're still in disbelief and processing this news. The Phoenix of Gaza XR project began by capturing Gaza outside the realm of death and destruction, or at least that's what we were trying to do, and to show the multiplicity of Gaza, the Gaza you people usually don't know, and people will never know in reality after its destruction and genocide. With Yahya and other team members, we encapsulated a side of Gaza that would never be seen in reality again. As we continue this project, we will continue to honor the resilience and insistence on making life out of the brutal Israeli siege that Yahya and all the people of Gaza want us to see. As we mourn, we ask how many more Palestinian lives will be taken away by the war on Gaza in a ruthless and senseless genocide that the world is watching, funding, supplying, and allowing to continue. How many more? Our U.S. tax dollars killed Yahya. Over 200 journalists and the tens of thousands of innocent souls in Gaza through weapons sales accompanied by logistical and political support, especially from the belly of the beast. May you rest in power, dear Yahya. We couldn't have done the work we do without your bravery and dedication. You will truly be missed, but your words live on. So this is from Yahya. By the way, I just want to explain that he sent us those words only a few days before he was killed, because for many months, you know, we have worked with him for a whole year, and he was in the north of Gaza. For many months, Yahya, we actually tried to conceal his identity to protect him, because you know that being a journalist, wearing the journalist vest actually makes you a target. And then at one point we thought, well, maybe we should consult with him. And he said, no, it's okay. I want you to actually show my identity, share my picture. You know, I'm okay with that. I'm a war photojournalist. And, you know, they know, you know, about my work. And so we said, okay, we are gonna do a poster about you like we did with the other photojournalist. And would you please share some words about yourself? Like introduce yourself through your own, you know, words. And he did, not knowing that he would killed. And you will see the painful reality in his words now, how he, when he talked to us about this, he almost predicted that he would be killed and said, like, it doesn't matter. You know, it's okay, you can share my name and my identity. So again, from Yahya, I'm Yahya Subah, a Palestinian journalist from Gaza City. I'm 32 years old. Since 2014, I have been documenting the truth through my lens, sharing with the world the voices of the people, their pain, their tears, and their silent screams. Yeah, at that time, I said, I lived a simple, beautiful life with my wife and two children, Bara and Kinan. Like any other family, we dreamt of living in peace, to laugh, to play, to gather around one table without fear. But on October 7, everything changed. In an instant, I lost my sister, my niece, my brother, my lifelong friend, and so many loved ones and relatives. I was no longer just the one documenting the tragedy. I became part of it. Of course, he wrote that, not knowing he would be the tragedy eventually. The camera I once carried to capture people's suffering now captured my own. The images of destruction were no longer just images of places. They were the remains of homes that once held the people I love. I wish to live a life full of love and peace with my family, to give my children a childhood that mirrored their dreams, but war denied us that. Today, I write to say, we are not just numbers in news reports. We are souls, families, hearts breaking every day, and dreams that never had a chance to live. I'm Yahya. Today, I report the news. Tomorrow, I might be the news. This is how we live in Gaza. Our martyrs don't die. They never die. Our martyrs will always be alive in their families, in their children, in their work, in every reel, in every image that Yahya captured for our work for the Phoenix of Gaza. He's there because it's 360, or traces of his presence is there. He will be immortalized through his amazing work and through his family and the love of his community.
That was Ahlam Mukhtaseb, professor of communication at California State University San Bernardino, on Palestinian journalist Yahya Sobeh, who died in an Israeli airstrike in Gaza City.
Yeah. This is for Palestine, the Mawla, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for the answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza. Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for the answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine.
while we listen to tunes made by ignorant fools. Israel blocked the UN from delivering food. They bring in the troops and you won't even glimpse at the news. They make money off the products that we're quick to consume. And it's not simply a question of differing views. Forget emotions, this is facts, what I spit is the truth. Makes no difference if you're a Christian or if you're a Jew. They're just people living in different conditions to you. They still die when you bomb their schools, mosques and hospitals. It's not because of rockets, please God, can you stop this all? I'm not related to the strangers on the TV, but I relate, cause those strangers could have been me. Words could never ever explain the raw tragedy. It's not a war, they're just murdering more rapidly. And we're automatically supporting pure savagery. Imagine how you feel if this was your family.
That was Loki. Long live Palestine. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasiliev. The assault on Gaza is being waged not only with bombs and blockades, but also by digital infrastructure, surveillance technology, and global media narratives. Major tech platforms are playing a role. Meta has been accused of censoring Palestinian voices. Microsoft technologies are entangled with military operations. Artificial intelligence tools are reportedly being used to monitor and target students. Meanwhile, media empires like Rupert Murdoch's continue to shape public opinion in ways that obscure the realities on the ground. Rapper and activist Loki joined Rania Khalik, host of Dispatches on Breakthrough News, to break down how digital systems are being used to suppress solidarity and how today's technologies are enabling the global infrastructure of repression.
What we recently learned about Meta, which is the company that owns Facebook and Instagram and WhatsApp, and its ties to the Israeli government. And I bring this up now, Loki, because there was a recent piece that came out in DropSite about new leaked data revealing, and I'm reading the headline for those who are just listening, leaked data reveals massive Israeli campaign to remove pro-Palestine posts on Facebook and Instagram. I mean, this really will really surprise no one who's been paying attention. But yeah, if you can kind of just walk us through the role that Meta is playing or has played and continues to play in Israel's genocidal apparatus, with this just being one aspect?
Well, when you're talking about Meta, you're of course talking about the parent company of Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp. And historically, all of those separate entities have had an interesting walk with the Israel lobby. So to start with, the individual that all of us know, Mark Zuckerberg, of course, funded the Zaka organization, which was credited with creating the 40 beheaded babies story. We also know that the Jan Koum, who was the founder of WhatsApp, not only funded AIPAC, but also funded other Israel lobby groups, but also organizations which build settlements, illegal settlements in the West Bank. The other point of contention with WhatsApp has obviously, since it was procured by Meta, has been the issue of whether it was providing information from the key platform WhatsApp to the Israelis in order to help them better target Palestinians in Gaza. We know that they had set this algorithm, which essentially would criminalize people if they were in WhatsApp groups alongside others who were deemed to be Palestinian resistance organizers, members, or fighters in some ways. Of course, it's well known that Meta has a long relationship with employing individuals that came out of Unit 8200 in the Israeli military. And in fact, I was able to find one individual who was working both for Meta and Unit 8200 at the same time, simultaneously, incredibly. And that individual was Yonatan Ramot, who worked for both Unit 8200 and Meta at the same time. But you also had so many other key figures at Facebook, for example, who in really sensitive positions like Eyal Klein worked as head of data science at Facebook at the same time, after being at Unit 8200 for 6 years. You also have other former Unit 8200 agents working in Meta like Tom Chet, head of activations and production for North American businesses. And of course, software developer Omer Goldberg and other software engineers like Gil Osher and Yoav Goldstein. These were also former individuals from Unit 8200. And then the question also has to be, when you look at how Meta procured the company Anavo in 2013. Now, this company, Anavo, was founded by Guy Rosen and Roy Tiger. Both of them were veterans of Military Intelligence Unit 8200. Now, here's the interesting aspect of it. Meta actually procured WhatsApp following obtaining Anavo, and Anavo acted as spyware, going into Facebook users' phones and monitoring their habits when using WhatsApp. And it was found that the information gained via this spying actually informed Meta's decision to buy WhatsApp in the first place. So the scandal around this actually forced Meta to shut down Anavo. However, its founder, Guy Rosen, went on to become the chief information security officer at Meta, heavily leaned on by Mark Zuckerberg. So this is the amazing thing, is that these former Israeli spies that were absorbed into the company Meta, actually, even though there were scandals linked to the intrusive and invasive nature of their operations at Meta, failed upwards. And in the case of Guy Rosen, became extremely important. We also have to remember that Meta, during the course of the genocide in Gaza, has not only been accused of shadow banning, but actually it's come out that 90,000 posts at least were deleted by Meta in response to direct approaches by the Israeli government. Now, what you also have to remember is that the key figure who is on the content moderating oversight board of Meta is Emi Palmer. Now, Emi Palmer was not only a former Israeli government censor, but she was also a Unit 8200 veteran, and she set up the cyber unit within the Israeli military to actually make the reports to companies like Facebook and Meta. And then she went on to find herself on the content moderating oversight board of the company. You know, throughout this war on Gaza, you've seen paid advertisements on Facebook telling Palestinians to leave their ancestral home and move to Jordan. And you've also seen paid adverts on Facebook calling for violence against Palestinians, including some even inciting a Holocaust for Palestinians. Now, a key point of this is that the global advertising chief at Meta is Nicola Mendelsohn. Now, she is the wife of Jonathan Mendelsohn, the former head of the Labour Friends of Israel. She has spoken at Israeli government-supported events in Tel Aviv and met with Shimon Peres while opening Facebook sites in Israel. And in addition to that, she actually met with Piers Morgan, who's a close family friend of both her and her husband, Jonathan Mendelsohn, throughout his coverage of the genocide in Gaza. So essentially what you're talking about is an entity which is more powerful than many governments in the world. It has access to information from individuals across many different jurisdictions. And so therefore, the company has a huge amount of power. And what we have to understand as a really decisive factor in this Gaza genocide and the war in Lebanon is that big tech has really been essential. The Nakba was the precursor to this war. And you have seen so much work put in to building up Israel's advantage in the technology sphere. And we have seen it play out in a really real way. If anyone has anything to do with any of these US companies in Gaza, then it is safe to say that that information is available to the Israelis. And actually, Meta is one of many tech companies who are essentially deeply integrated with Israeli occupation and violence.
I mean, that's a really important breakdown. And I just want to, just to go back to the piece I was referencing to open with from DropSite, I just wanted to quote from it. The data that was leaked to them shows that Meta has complied with 94% of takedown requests issued by Israel since October 7th, 2023. And Israel is the biggest originator of takedown requests globally by far. And one thing I found interesting here, because this speaks to something I've often referencing on my show since I had Dr. Lara Sheha on here, because she makes this point about how Israel's occupation exists far outside of the territory that, you know, that, that Israel controls, where they have these sort of other forms of occupation, like in places like even the US, and you could say even in the tech sphere. And the reason I raise that is because government requests for takedowns, this is according to this piece, generally focus on posts made by citizens inside that government's borders. Meta insiders said, what makes Israel's campaign unique is its success in censoring speech in many countries outside of Israel. What's more, Israel's censorship project will echo well into the future, insiders said, as the AI program Meta is currently training how to moderate content will base future decisions on the successful takedown of content critical of Israel's genocide. And interestingly enough, the vast majority of content that the Israelis requested Meta takedown, and again, 94% of those requests Meta follows through on, were in Arab and Muslim countries. So, you know, people just speaking across the region about Israel's genocide in Gaza are having their content taken down. And Facebook is basically creating an, or crafting a narrative through suppression and censorship based on what Israel wants. I also wanted to mention one woman who I'm sure you know her name, Jordana Cutler, who's also played a huge role in both the Israeli government side of things and the Facebook side of things. She is Meta's Director of Public Policy for Israel and the Jewish diaspora. And she's intervened repeatedly to investigate pro-Palestine content. She's also a former senior Israeli government official and advisor to the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. She's constantly using her role to frame the narrative in Israel's favor and advocate for censorship. So I don't know if you want to comment on any of that before we move on, but it really is important for people to understand just how fully integrated Israel's intelligence apparatus is in this enormous tech company.
Well, actually, it's a well-established policy of Israel to surround the company both from within and without, from outside and inside. And so Jordana Cutler went from being an advisor to Benjamin Netanyahu, having a key position at Likud, to being the chief of staff at the Israeli embassy in Washington, to then going directly into the sensitive position at Facebook. And so what they do is essentially populate Israeli agents within the company and then make complaints from the Israeli government, which are then received by the Israeli government, were received by the Israeli agents within the company, who then exact policy within the company on the basis of the reports that they have received. So the case of Facebook and Meta generally is definitely lock in step with all of that.
Yeah, it really is incredible the way these, I mean, it's brilliant on the part of the Israelis, I suppose, if you want narrative controls, to get ahead of everything by doing this, especially when you recognize that the world is increasingly hating you. Another tech company I wanted to ask you to talk about a bit is Microsoft, which recently made headlines because a few of its employees were protesting Microsoft's collaboration with the Israeli army. And perhaps that will surprise some people, or maybe not, but can you talk to us a bit about Microsoft's role here in Israel's death machine?
So what you had was the Moroccan Ibtihal Abu Assad, if I remember correctly, interrupting the Microsoft AI CEO, Mustafa Soleiman, during a live streamed conference protesting about the use of Microsoft Azure cloud technology for the Israelis. And really, Microsoft has been involved in the Israeli war machine in a myriad of ways for a very, very long time. Actually, you had previously Highfield Capital, one of the highest shareholders in Microsoft with 31 million shares. Now, the chairman of that firm, Jonathan Jacobson, was also the chairman of Israel's Institute for National Security Studies at the same time. Now, that's a key Israeli intelligence think tank. He was a trustee of Birthright Israel and also was a funder of Settlements and the Friends of the IDF. So clearly, as a top shareholder in Microsoft, he would have wielded serious influence on what Microsoft did or didn't do. You also have to remember that Microsoft has absorbed into it several Israeli tech companies which were founded by alumni of the Israeli military. For instance, Orato, Adolim, Hexadite, and CyberX. These were all developed by Israeli military figures. And also Microsoft previously invested in an Israeli company called AnyVision, which was involved directly in facial recognition of Palestinians for the Israeli occupation. And Microsoft has also, for a long time, collaborated with both Elbit Systems and Israeli Aerospace Industries and provided Xbox controllers for use in controlling Israeli tanks. We know that Microsoft dispatched mentors to an Israeli military hackathon that lasted for 24 hours, during which you had a way in which Microsoft experts were able to guide Israeli cadets and soldiers on how to use their stuff, identify their enemies, and control robots with drones. And also you have the Microsoft HoloLens, which is a sort of mixed virtual reality device which the Israeli military uses. You also have Microsoft's key role at the Israeli Army Officers Training Base, Bahad 1, where they have an app that allows soldiers to have access to their information and Israeli military protocol. Also, Microsoft is vital to the operations of the Israeli police. They provide cloud service to the police, which secures classified information. And also the body cameras that the Israeli police use also come directly from key Microsoft partner by the name of Taser. So there's many different ways in which Microsoft has been deeply integrated with the Israelis. It actually launched its first cloud data center in Israel with hundreds of millions of dollars invested in it from the United States. There's also a particular app which the Israeli army uses called the Munasak, which is the coordinator. And basically, this coordinator app is used by the Israeli civil administration in the West Bank to manage the issuing of permits to Palestinians for any work within the political entity of Israel, and that runs on the Microsoft Azure. And that Munasak is actually key to authenticating the details of Palestinians. You also have another Microsoft app, which is used by the Israeli military, the soldiers themselves. So it contains facial recognition for the soldiers and fingerprints. And also you have another key collaboration of Microsoft with the Israeli military MAMRAM unit, which enables intelligence gathering through that unit. Another Israeli military unit that they work with is the Shahar unit. And so you have basically about 150 soldiers, officers working specifically with Microsoft technology to run that. There's so many ways, literally an unending amount of ways in which Microsoft is deeply involved in the Israeli occupation and including inside settlements. So, for example, the Ariel University, which is located in the Israeli settlement of Ariel in the West Bank, has a huge amount of free Microsoft services available to it, the students there. So there's many ways in which Microsoft should and can be targeted for the way in which it has assisted Israel across this time. And with the overall story of the Israeli genocide and Zionist genocide of the Palestinians, Microsoft has played a key role. And those two employees who actually interrupted the 50th anniversary celebration were, of course, fired for that move by them. So it's really a sordid tale. And I think really the role of big tech in this latest chapter of the Palestinian dispossession and genocide will go down as a decisive factor in the story, I would say.
Yeah, it's certainly a modern day example of a lot of things we look back at during the Nazi Holocaust, for example. I think one of the most famous companies known for participating on that corporate tech side of things is IBM. And these companies will go down in history doing that. And, you know, I just want to make the point that So often we talk about Palestine being a laboratory, and that goes for tech as well. All of these tech companies, and you can go on like different like BDS websites that will lay out for you. I know Palestine Youth Movement probably also does as well, lay out for you the involvement of these companies and what you can do to boycott them. But, you know, it's not just Microsoft. It's not just Meta. It's also Palantir, Amazon, Salesforce, Dell, you know, HP. You can go on and on and on. There's all these kinds of companies that are involved in various ways in Israel's death apparatus, in settler colonizing Palestine. And all of these same companies are now trying to make a profit and are fighting each other for contracts to participate in Donald Trump's deportation apparatus that is actually being launched right now against pro-Palestine activists who are non-citizens in the United States. So you can take there's a thread from what happens in Gaza to what happens in the US to really all around the world and the way these tech companies are used in repression. It's not to say that like tech is, you know, inherently bad or AI is inherently bad. I mean, that's a different conversation. I know some people might disagree with me on that. I think it can be quite useful. But the fact of the matter is, in this horrible imperialist system that we live in, these companies are making it all possible and more effective and actually quite scary. And, you know, all that's to say, I wanted to ask you just your thoughts on the fact that this is, you know, I don't know if you have any particular insight into this, Loki, but I just thought it was fascinating. You know, the pro-Israel groups in the U.S. have been actually using AI. Pro-Israel groups have been using AI to identify and report student protesters for possible deportations and then handing those lists of potential deportees over to the Trump administration. It's just incredible. I don't know if there's any similarities to what you're seeing take place in the UK in terms of the behavior of these pro-Israel groups who we've always been warning about. But it seems like right now, I mean, they're all of the dangers that people were saying they posed to domestically in places like the US and across the European countries are on full display right now.
Well, also, I think it's key at this point to read this book by Yasha Levine entitled, Surveillance Valley, because what he does, which no one else has done, is trace a history of the internet. And the way that he posits it is being created by the US military in order to map out civilizations that they hope to exert imperial domination over, because they viewed a failure in Vietnam was not correctly mapping the population and being able to predict their behavior. And so when the internet was being developed at MIT and other US educational institutions, there were actually sit-ins and protests against the development of the internet on the basis that it would invade people's privacy. And so this infrastructure of information that has been set up across these decades is really now playing out in front of us in the way that Israel has fought this war and the informational advantage that it has had from being able to insinuate itself into supply chains, in ways of targeting individuals, in the ways of tracing Ismail Haniyeh via WhatsApp. This is a long way from poisoning wells and the Deir Yassin massacre. We are talking a massive, massive difference in the Zionist movement. And that is due to the invention of the internet in between the Nakba, the Naxa, and then what we have now, which is ultimately will be seen as the bigger Nakba, in my humble opinion. And I think it's for that reason that that book by Yasha Levine really will answer some questions, because when we look at all of these companies, they are part of that same infrastructure. And really, it's not a question of which companies are with Israel. It's a question of which company or companies might not be with Israel. And ultimately, once the information is put into this system, it's up for grabs. And what Israel did in 2012, in an article in Calculus Tech identified it, is Netanyahu set a policy whereby they would try to siphon individuals out of Unit 8200 into private tech companies. And one of the key ways they did that is through an organization founded by Paul Singer called the Startup Nation Central. And what that sought to do was make BDS an impossibility by integrating these Israeli intelligence units like 8200 or the Talpot with key US tech companies and also direct jobs towards Israel as well at the same time. And we've seen that advantage play out, I would say.
That was rapper and activist Loki speaking to Rania Kallik, host of Dispatches on Breakthrough News.
As you prepare your breakfast, think of others. Do not forget to feed the pigeons. As you wage your wars, think of others. Do not forget those who fight for peace. As you pay your water bill, think of others, those who are nursed by clouds. As you return home to your home, think of others. Do not forget the people of the camps. As you sleep and count the stars, think of others, those who have nowhere to sleep. As you liberate yourself with metaphors, think of others, those who have lost their right to speak. As you think of others far away, think of yourself and say, if only I were a candle in the night.
This is for Palestine, of course, the capital, Jerusalem. Unarmed people marching to the wall when they're shooting them. Suppression is a question, resistance is the answer. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza. Palestine, of course, the capital, Jerusalem. Unarmed people marching to the wall when they're shooting them. Suppression is a question, resistance is the answer. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza.
All you see is war every time you turn your head and bloodshed on the floor. Mother cries, who cries for her this time? There's truth between these walls. See the lies between the lines. They hide where the bullets coming from. From the tyrant dressed in our disguise.
I'ma ride until the end, even if I gotta push back for all my friends. Cause you know that I'm a fighter. Let me see a lighter. And we not gonna stop, the Palestine is free. But still you know that I'ma ride until the end, even if I gotta push back for all my friends. Cause you know that I'm a fighter. Let me see a lighter. And we not gonna stop, the Palestine is free.
Taught to not know, taught to be blind, taught to not care. Tell me what's real, borderlines, military despair. How to exist if there's no rights to be human in fear. And if you take away your home, where's the house supposed to live? Taught to not know, taught to be blind, taught to not care. Tell me what's real, borderlines, military despair. How to exist if there's no rights to be human in fear. And if you take away your home, where's the house supposed to live?
This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Polina Vasilyev. Turkey, under the presidency of Recep Tayyip Erdogan, supported the Al-Qaeda affiliate whose leader is now the president of Syria. Erdogan has also fueled the growth of Islamic fundamentalism across the Middle East. Derya Koca, a journalist and activist with the Socialist Workers' Party of Turkey, spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
The United States has been very much involved in Turkey, particularly in overthrowing Turkish governments with coups, 1980, with military coups, and instituting privatization of Turkey. The United States has pushed privatization of telecom, of many different industries in Turkey to benefit American capitalists who wanted to invest in Turkey, and also has supported the rise of fundamentalism in Turkey and the Erdogan government. The economic crisis now in Turkey is ongoing, the inflation. What is the economic situation for the working class in Turkey today? And what is that creating as far as a fight back by the Turkish working class and Kurdish working class?
Yes, it's a very good beginning to emphasize the pro-imperialist, determine Erdogan as a pro-imperialist and pro-US power in Turkey, because the fundamental Islamism or moderate Islamism was determined as a tool to rule the whole Middle Eastern countries because the revolutionary ideas and the socialist wave was so powerful among these countries, Turkey, Syria, Iraq, Egypt, Palestine. All these countries were very left tendencies, have very strong left tendencies. The biggest forces, of course, was Stalinist forces, but they had seen this as a very big threat, and they intentionally supported, fed, and sponsored and financed the Islamist powers. Without this international support, Erdogan's just popular vote had no capability to build up this kind of an oppressive regime. He is already a pro-capitalist, pro-Western imperialist power, but his rise in the rule to the office dates back to United States support in the very beginning of the 2000s. And from that date, the working class in Turkey is experiencing a rapid impoverishment. Following the 2001 economic crisis in Turkey, Erdogan came to power with popular support, but with an international support of the imperialism. But his reaction, his electoral victory was a reaction of the masses against the establishment parties, which was very similar to Trump. When 2008 crisis hit the global capitalism, an influx of hot money, cheap foreign currency, and capital started into peripheral countries, including Turkey. During this period, a massive expansion of capital and markets, along with cheap foreign currency, created a false perception of prosperity and purchasing power. Erdogan and Lula had the government at the same date in Brazil, the same dynamics. It was a left populism. Here, it was the right-wing populism. Erdogan used his economic development in his favor and used a deep identity polarization among working classes and among Kurdish and Turkish people, split them into four, five, how much he can do, and make all these neoliberal reforms into practice, turned them into practice, and started a huge privatization campaign. I think it is the 90% of all privatization of the modern history of Turkey. Unions organized in the public sectors were weakened, and pressure on the working class and the left increased, causing a continuous erosion from that on. Moreover, all that cheap money was invested in primarily in the construction sector, but just wasted. They used to make this urban rent to turn into a pro-Erdogan support, a political support from new emerging capitalist circles. Now, global dynamics are moving in the opposite direction. The balance of power between the US and China, more dynamics in the Middle East, and the international crisis are now deeply affecting Turkey also, very similar to Argentina again. Turkey is experiencing a crisis in which working classes, the pensioners, the students, the ordinary people living a very daily struggle and a very deep poverty. For now, they try to control the currency. They try to prevent a huge unemployment, but that means an austerity plan, a very brutal austerity plan, is on the rise. For example, pensioners are in a terrible situation. Most of them have to keep working to survive till death. Buying meat is almost impossible for a pensioner in Turkey. And paying for their rents is impossible in big cities. It is impossible. It is also impossible for students to study without working. Turkey has a population of 81 million, and 8.5 million workers earn only a minimum wage. This means, including their families, this represents nearly 40 million people living under the poverty line, hunger line, with minimum wage. Moreover, Turkey has the longest working hours among the OECD countries. Despite high inflation, wages have been kept low under the guise of suppressing inflation. And for the past 4 years, causing a continuous impoverishment, and there are several budget problems in areas such as education and healthcare. Food inflation and the rents are two biggest issues. In Turkey, even if you graduate from a good university, it is nearly impossible to live alone in an apartment alone. Social activities like cultural activities are just luxuries. Currently, we are witnessing a wave of protests led by youth. And as I already mentioned, this extreme poverty is another dynamic why youth are on the streets. And the unemployment, the lack of future, hopelessness, long working hours, extremely low wages, among the key dynamics behind this movement.
The other issue of the economic crisis is the basically this privatization and looting of the country. Trump now has just visited the Emirates, theocracy there, and made financial arrangements, gotten a jet for $400 million for himself. But also the looting of the Turkish economy, has that gone on? It seems like Trump sees what Erdogan done is something that he should take up as far as making personal wealth in the economy. Is that going on in Turkey? Is there a connection?
Yes, yes. Erdogan himself was a poor leader. He was a poor grassroots movement in the Islamist movement. That's why in the poor neighborhoods, that Islamist movement was supported against the establishment parties. Now Erdogan is one of the richest men among these authoritarian governments. He only wants himself to rule whole country with judiciary, not judiciary, no parliamentary branches, no ministries, just Erdogan himself rules the country now. No media, no independent media, just two or three weak TV channels broadcasting opposition ideas. All courts, media, any state offices, just in one hand in Erdogan. And criticizing in them openly, even in the street interviews, means that you will be jailed.
And many journalists have also been jailed in Turkey.
Hundreds. Most of them are Kurdish. And it is a very daily issue to be arrested and jailed for a journalist in Turkey. But they do not do it with even following the ordinary judicial processes. No, they raid your houses in the middle of the night, and they take all the digitals, all the devices, and they don't give it back anymore. And probably you will be jailed. After a couple of months, you will be released. And this is a kind of lifestyle for a journalist in Turkey. This is happening regularly.
And the issue of the expansion of Turkey, I mean, Erdogan has said that he wanted to be the new Ottoman Empire, to rebuild the empire. The intervention in Syria, the Syrian war, his going to Syria, the army there, and also the expansion of Turkey to rebuild the Ottoman Empire. What's behind that? And what has that meant for the people of Turkey, and particularly the Syrians and minorities in Turkey?
Yes, that's a very good question. The presence of U.S. imperialism in the region, particularly through the Syrian war, expanded significantly during Erdogan's rule. Erdogan's international support for Syrian war directly served all the interests of U.S. imperialism. In return, he received a substantial support from both U.S. and the EU, because his desire to be the new caliphate, the new Ottoman leader, and it is a serious pan-Islamist project. For instance, jihadist terrorists who were funded and trained to fight in Syria enter through Turkish territory. they still stay in Turkish territory. Turkish military, Turkish intelligence services, and Turkish jihadist terrorists, together with the all state power and the budget, fight in Syria. They stayed in Turkey for extended periods and were even treated in state hospitals. In terms of jihadist terrorism and war crimes, Erdogan is a major accomplice. They are responsible for millions of people's bloodshed. And they are responsible for Alevite people is now massacred and executed by Golani regime in Syria. This mutual beneficial relationship aligned with Erdogan's grand political Islam project and his ambitions to become a major leader in the Middle East. Both sides are profited from this arrangement. The plan for Syrian refugees to remain in Turkey also became another project for the EU and the US, because he gave big guarantees for them and they still keeping his word. And refugees flows to Europe were halted, but millions of Syrian refugees remained in Turkey without any legal rights, merely labeled as guests, leading to extreme exploitation. Immigrants from Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Iran, live in dire poverty and exploitation in Turkey. According to the law, according to the migration law in Turkey, if you want to be a refugee, you should be coming from the Western countries, not Eastern countries. If you are an English guy, you can be a refugee in Turkey, but who wants this? That's the question. Turkey is not the best place to be a refugee for a Westerner. So these vile anti-immigrant sentiments were somewhat suppressed due to Islamist ideology. Erdogan's weakening has now led to the rise of far-right parties that again the strength through the anti-immigrant rhetoric, as we have been seeing in EU countries. There is a similar phenomenon in Turkey. However, I think I also think it is important to emphasize one point. Erdogan is not simply a puppet of imperialism. The Turkish state is a sub-imperialist power and regional actor capable of playing relatively autonomous roles. For example, Erdogan's sponsorship of group HDS militants trapped in Idlib and his role in Golani terrorists attempted to seize power in Syria, while the U.S. had determined to decrease its military capacity in Syria. The guarantee was for this project was Erdogan's authority in the ground. So Erdogan did not abandon this project, even when U.S. almost conceded defeat and agreed Assad's victory, at least Putin's victory in Syria. But Erdogan succeeded in carrying forward, earning Trump's admiration and praise. Developing drone technology, making moves in Karabakh war in Azerbaijan, and pursuing some imperialist agendas set Erdogan apart from being a mere puppet. Yes, yet he still operates within the boundaries drawn by U.S. imperialism. On the other hand, Trump's return to power in the U.S. opened many doors for Erdogan, including declaring the last repressive move against the right to vote in Turkey. When Trump came to power, Erdogan swiftly began implementing his authoritarian agenda. He imprisoned his strongest opponent, and 3 years before the election, set the stage to enter the elections potentially without any real rivals, aiming to establish a fully authoritarian regime. So without gaining power in the international arena, without any support from the international arena, you can just implement these agendas all alone.
That was Daria Koja, journalist and activist with the Socialist Workers Party of Turkey, speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Steve Zeltzer, Freddy Libertad, and myself, Paulina Vasiliev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Paulina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.